gentlemen, welcome to the Hammersmith Apollo. Please put your hands together and welcome on stage, Dara O'Brien.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, welcome, welcome to this glorious Art Deco wonderland that is the Hammersmith Apollo. Are you in good form?
Yeah. Woo-ray! Oh, I love this guy. He's really good. This performance was filmed here in the Hammersmith Apollo about midway through a tour, which meant I've done the show about 177 times, not just across the UK and Ireland, but everywhere from Reykjavik to Moscow, from Dubai to Sydney. But it's a two-hour show, and this is a 60-minute edited version of it. So you're not going to see the whole thing. In fact, you miss out on all these routines. Oh, there's some real gold there as well. Also, as we skip through the show, there'll be the odd moment where you'll be going, what are the audience laughing at? And sorry. However, you do get to see the appearance and disappearance of an audience member, unscripted, me telling the story of my own actual death, and right at the very end, my favourite anecdote that I've ever told on stage. So, enjoy the show, and we start with me, midway through the first half, talking for some reason about builders.
This is like show 104 or something of the tour, and it's just nice to be out in the road, not in any kind of a, you know, wank. Oh, so great to be. We've got builders in. It's just nice to be out in the road and have somebody worry about that every day, because Jesus, they're there every day, and they're always going to be there, because it doesn't have any indication of when they leave. I mean, you ask a builder, how long will this take? And it's like, they're unique in jobs the world over. It doesn't matter how many years experience they have, how many decades they've been in the industry. They have nothing to draw on when it comes to guessing how long a job will take. It's literally a wall from there to there. How long will it take? Could be a month, could be 4 years. Difficult to know. Either way, every day we'll be here when you see us. It'll be fantastic. Now, I love that joke, but it's never going to be the biggest joke in the show, because it slices through an audience in terms of what age you are and how much of life you've lived. For example, bingo, yourself, champ, what age are you? 20 years old. I'm taking a wild guess that that routine was completely wasted on you. Can I... Flum in every direction. No idea. What's your name, champ?
Tom.
How are you, Tom? That's grand, Tom. You're in your 20s, as are many other people in this room here. And you've got to know you've come to a show being done by a 46-year-old man. And there will be things in the show that speak to a life that you've yet to live, okay? So you got to come with me. I don't mean the band. You're only 20. I wouldn't have known either. So you got to come with me on some of this stuff, like whatever. And I know this, right? I'm not an idiot. I try out these shows in tiny portions, in little comedy clubs, in Covent Garden on a Tuesday night. These are 25-year-olds in London. They'll never own a house in their fucking lives. I might as well have walked out there with a brick in my hand and going, you see this? You'll never have one of these. So that will happen. So, Tom, you got to come with us on that kind of thing. Will you do that for the night, Tom? Good man yourself. We'll find something universal, Tom. We'll find something universal. Draw the old crowd back in again. Will you do that, Tom? Good man yourself, Tom. Tom, do you know when you're buying a tapestry or a woven good in... in an Arabian souk? You know yourself, Tom, when you're moving from stall to stall and the dirhams are burning a hole in your pocket and you don't know which of the many tapestries or woven goods to buy, because it's a bewildering choice of beautiful work. That part of the world, they create incredible tapestries, incredible woven rugs and goods. It's really gorgeous, but with one really interesting thing. And I don't know, by the way, if it's a Muslim issue of faith or whether it's an Arab cultural thing, but they believe in that part of the world that only God can create something perfect. So it's arrogant of man to presume that he can create something that is itself perfect. So they deliberately drop a stitch in any of these beautiful tapestries and goods as a sign of humility in the face of the divine, right? And I find that quite an interesting, I'm not a religious man, but I find it quite a very interesting cultural thing to do. Similarly, my builders believe... that only God can fit a kitchen and have fecked it up repeatedly in ways I couldn't even have anticipated. Let me charge my phone, I'll turn on the plug. There's the water. That can't be right. That can't be something we intended to do, right? Oh, by the way, we'll just take a pause for 1 second so we can enjoy. 104 dates I've done this tour, and every night we contact the theatre in advance and say, listen, during a bit of the show, there'll be a bit where Dara will talk to the audience, but he'll do it from a seated position in a kind of an informal way that he's quite enjoying doing at the moment. So all we need you to supply is a table and perhaps a nice chair, such as somebody would have at a dinner party. Well done, the Hammersmith Apollo, for this particular check. For, you know, that retro dinner party that feels like an exam hall in the 1990s, right? Please, come, sit with us and have dinner and write an essay about German expansion in the 1800s, right? Let's go back to Tom for a second, shall we? Tom, how are you? How are you, Tom? Where are you from? From the Isle of Wight, Tom. You travelled all the way here from the island. Did you raft up here yourself, Tom?
I actually came from Edinburgh.
You came from Edinburgh? Well, you got those tickets late, didn't you, Tom? Eh? That's not the best route. Have you checked that out on a map at any stage? Who the hell goes from the Isle of Wight to London via Edinburgh, for God's sake? Are you some sort of... Were you in danger of being hacked and you thought you'd reroute the phone call to a series of different locations? Are you a spy, Tom? Is that it? Is there little else you can tell me here to send the package via Scotland? That way nobody... Did you shake somebody off at Edinburgh Airport and then duck back in through security with a secret boarding pass they didn't know you have? And now you're in London and you're... Oh, somebody's up in Edinburgh going, curse you, Tom, as your plane took off again. If that is your real name, Tom. Oh... So what do you do, Tom? What do you do? What's your cover story when you're spying for whoever you spy for, circling your way through all the airports trying to shake off tails?
Student.
You're a student. A student. That's a good one, Tom. That's a wink. You're a student. A student of what, Tom? What is your name? Your...
Anthropology.
Of anthropology. That's suitably vague, isn't it? That just means looking at people, doesn't it, Tom? That's exactly what that means. Possibly through a newspaper with eye holes cut out of it. Me, sure, I'm only an anthropologist, an innocent anthropologist, examining people through my newspaper here. No, please go about your business. Oh, fuck, I didn't cut one on these pages. Now I've only got one eye going out. This hasn't worked out. I've not thought this through. I'm not the best spy there's ever been, for God's sake, right? And what's your favourite of all the many civilizations? When we're doing all this to work in the house, like whatever, the thing I thought would make it bearable for me, all these ridiculous meetings about skirting boards or whatever, would be if I could put toys into the house, right? And specifically, I wanted something like Alexa, one of these on, you know, always on speakers, like whatever. And the image I had was purely a kind of a, this is very male kind of a thing, that I would walk into the house with my lady on my arm and I would go, Alexa, play some Prince. And then the sexy music would just really smoothly start and the mood would be set and it'd be very romantic. Obviously, the reality of both artificial intelligence and voice recognition software is you're far more likely to go, Alexa, play some Prince. And Alexa will go, printing documents now. And then you have to fuck to the incessant rhythm of the printer. And that is incredibly difficult to maintain. I'm not a young man anymore. I can do 5-6 minutes tops of that before I am praying for a paper jam or any kind of ink cartridge problems or something. Instead, I went for one of the ones that's on the phone, right? And one of the ones you can control all the services in your house just by pressing buttons on your phone. Because I had an idea over the course of a long tour, 2-year tour, that it'd be nice every evening around about this part of the show to take out this and show people, like the big tech nerd that I am, look, you can turn the lights on and off in your house just by doing this. Not that that would be of any entertainment value to any audience anywhere, but just for me, over the course of a 2-year tour, it would just be pleasing to know that every evening, no matter where I was in the world, my wife would be sitting at home minding her own business when all of a sudden all of the lights are going off wildly all over the house. But obviously, you can play this game. You can put anything electric onto it, anything motor. You can put the curtains in your bedroom onto this app, as I found out last summer, to my excitement. I was asleep in bed, deep sleep, REM sleep, a dream sleep, having a very vivid dream about having to buy a new unicorn because the unicorn races were coming up, so I needed a new unicorn, so I had to go and get a new unicorn. You know yourselves. So I had to go to the unicorn shop, and the unicorn shop near me is run by my old English teacher from school. And I go, geez, what are you doing here, running a unicorn shop? And we're chatting about it, and then it got very bright in the unicorn unicorn shop. I said, Jesus, you keep this unicorn shop very bright. He says, I don't. And the unicorns are blinking furiously and banging their horns off each other, clearly in some distress. I go, why is it so bright? He says, it's not bright in the shop, you idiot. It's bright in the real world. Wake up, for Christ's sake. And I woke up and the room was flooded with light because my wife on the train to work at 7:15 a.m. had taken out her phone and gone, time he got up, bash. So this is escalating. I have now put onto the same app heating and air conditioning so I can plunge individual rooms into cold and dark and then use Spotify to play children singing nursery rhymes from the basement. I did this once and then I went off stage at the break and my wife rang me and said, you seem to have forgotten that I was on call tonight. And I've actually been called into work, but I just had a text from the babysitter and she's fucking shitting herself. I wanted to get some toy. In the whole thing of what am I going to put in the house? What's going to be for me in the house, right? I said, I want some toys. If I'm going to sit through all these meetings, I want some toys. And what I settled on getting was a virtual reality gaming setup, right? How many people here have tried VR? Yes. Few of you dotted around. Let's say a tenth of the room have tried VR, right? It's not a new thing. It's been around for a few years. It should be everywhere because genuinely, it's amazing. It's an incredible piece of technology. You put the mask on. There's separate screens for each eyeball. It's got little things called accelerometers that know which way you're tilting your head. You put the headphones in. You move. Suddenly, you're totally immersive. You're in a different universe, an entirely artificial world created for you. I'm still here, but then back in again. Oh my God, it's incredible. It's genuinely stunning. It's going to change gaming. It's going to change movies. It's going to revolutionize burglary. Burglary as an art form. Once you break into a house with somebody with a mask on, they don't know you're there. Just take your time. Choose what you want. There's no rush. You can go, that's worth more money, but that'll look good in the hall. You can make it. It's a whole different set of criteria for being a burglar now, right? But it is the thing that very few people have had a go at relative to everyone else. And one of the reasons that VR isn't everywhere is that nobody is using it to watch porn. That seems like a slightly weird thing to say, but porn is amazingly important in technology and new technology. The stuff that's used for porn becomes incredibly popular relative to other things in this market. Like that porn is the reason that Blu-ray beat the other kind of DVD all those years ago. Porn is the reason a certain number of video streaming software became more popular than other kinds of video streaming software. The stuff that's used for porn is the stuff that'll be used in the marketplace. And nobody is watching porn in VR. And I sort of get why. I mean, men are visual creatures. I'm not naive. But no man, while actually making love, has ever gone, oh my God, darling, oh, this is incredible. Oh, this is amazing. Oh my God, I'm almost there. Let me just have a quick look around the flat. Oh, fantastic. Oh, I can see the roof and everything. That's amazing. Oh, there's a floor. Oh, there's a wave. There's a roof again. Oh, there's a floor. Is that cornicing original now, or did you have that put in later? But the main reason that people aren't using aren't using VR for porn is because you cannot be entirely sure that she's out for the afternoon. And I mean 100% sure, because this is a high-stakes game. You don't know she's back, and you don't look good are the two things you have to consider. You do not want your loved one going, oh, I forgot my credit card, I better go back in. Ah! What is this you're doing to yourself? Jesus! Yes, I was bringing the kids to my mother's house for the weekend, but we had to come back. The little one was in, and this is what greets us on our return. The nightmare. You finish the wank of the century. You take off the mask. And there are three police officers just staring. Going, do you have no idea what's been going on here for the last while? A burglar broke into your house. He was spotted, we were called, There's been a standoff. You've been a hostage for 45 minutes. We've had to close off your route. Sky News have a helicopter slowly circling over your house. Your wife is outside on a megaphone going, "Stay strong, John, stay strong." And all the time we've been watching you on the thermal imaging, just battering away at yourself. These tours that we do now, these tours go on for ages and ages and ages. They go on for, honestly, they go on for about 2 years, a tour now. And only, mainly, the main reason it goes on for 2 years is because they go to loads of different countries all over the world, right? There was a period during the last tour, a show we did called Crowd Tickler, where the three gigs I had in order were Plymouth, Dubai, Oslo. They were the three shows I had, one after the other, right? And that's kind of freaky, not only in terms of what to pack, but also just in terms of what the reaction and stuff around is going to be, like whatever. For example, the people presume that the show changes, and the show doesn't change at all. The show becomes very, very universal, but the stuff around the show changes enormously, right? Dubai, for example, is an incredibly religious part of the world. Dubai, we were told by the producers over there, they contacted us to tell us that the state police, the licensing authority, the Dubai police, basically, had got in contact just to check that, as they put it, the show was suitable for public performance in that very religious state. And obviously I got very kind of, oh, how dare they censor me, how dare they not let me tell my truth on stage, right? They said, no, relax, it's not that bad at all. Actually, the question they asked was, genuinely the question from the Dubai police was, does the show contain sexy movement? Was the show they asked. And I think you'll agree, it's pretty much wall-to-wall sexy movement, the show I do. Which is ironic, really, because when you have sex with me, I don't move at all. Very much your time to shine. Totally love that joke. It's possibly my favourite joke in the show. And I'll do another joke in a minute, but first I cannot get over the fact that we seem to have lost Tom and him from the front row. What the fuck happened there? That has thrown me. I've been trying to fucking work that out as I'm doing that joke. Where the fuck? This gives too much credence to the whole Tom is a spy rumour from earlier on, that Tom's cover got blown in the first half and Tom has now been whacked at some stage. The fuck happened to Tom and his mate? Did they not come back after the break?
Past his bedtime.
I know he was very young, God love him, but that's... Hello, shush, say nothing. Oh. The sense of relief for a start. But now, like a parent, I'm... And where were you until now? Your father and I have been worried sick about you. We thought we'd lost you in London, for God's sake. You're an island boy. You're not trained to find your way around London. We weren't going to put any of the audience stuff into the fucking DVD, but you have made it necessary for us to make the entire thing about you and your disappearance. Well, I hope you got your drinks anyway. Happy now? You happy now? Welcome to an evening with Tom. Anyway, Norway, right? But before this random cheer appeared of you returning, good to have you. Whatever you do, Tom, move that point, because you will kick it with your leg and then it'll be, the whole thing will have been for no good whatsoever, right? It's a chaser. Anyway, I was in Norway, we travelled all these places, Trumstone, Buda, and all these places around, and they're fantastically friendly people, they're delightful people. I was on this plane going up to Trumstone, on the very far north of Norway, like, and I'm reading a guidebook, around it, when a bloke from like four seats across leans over and goes, "Is it your first time in northern Norway?" And I went, "Yes. Yes, it is. But I'm a very sophisticated international traveller." So I went, I hear, I said, "The people of northern Norway are very different to the people of southern Norway," which is the way sophisticated international travellers talk. Right? And this guy, being Norwegian, wants to give me as full an answer as possible, right? And he goes, "Yes," he says, "the people of northern Norway are more..." And there was a genuine pause while he tried to find the right word. And then he came back with, Latino. And there are many words I would use to describe the people of Northern Norway. But Latino would be a long way down the list of possible adjectives. I mean, they're lovely people, but they lack a certain... Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. Come to Northern Norway with the aurora borealis, but also the fruit on my head. Ah, da 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 da. So you travel around from all these places, and you've got to write a show that's going to work from different continents, from different climates. It's ridiculous, right? And you're kind of going, geez, how do you write a show like that? Certain rules are unbreakable. Certain rules are inviolable in comedy. You've got to say stuff in the right order. That is the single most important thing you can do, right? And it's very easy to break that rule. The last show I did was a show called Crowd Tickler, which I did here for a while and did all over the country. Some of you have seen it, yeah. I've seen it on DVD. Some of you may have seen it. It was the one that ended with their whole routine about sexiness and why is what is sexy to one gender often bewildering to the other gender, right? It had a thing in it about pole dancers. Why don't pole dancers just stand next to the pole, take out one tit, bang it against the poles, put that tit in, take the other tit out, go from the other direction, right? That laugh is worth nothing to me now. That's from the previous show, right? It was the routine probably most famously ended with it was all about stockings and why this is where the sexy lives and why don't men have to wear lingerie? And it ends with me wearing a pair of, like, wearing male lingerie, a male glove lingerie that goes up to mid-arm and walking around in me sexy gloves. And the very last words of me lifting up my arms and saying the words, look at me elbows, which is a reference to a joke about elbows from like an hour earlier, right? And the way it works with the audience is they're all rolling along with the show anyway, enjoying it, but then you get this kind of double laugh when they recognise the thing from earlier on. There's a kind of a whip crack of a laugh, at which point I use that whip crack to go, thank you very much, good night, and then walk off. It's a cheap trick, but you fuckers keep falling first, so I'm going to keep doing it. Right? So I'll do the show 150 times across the tour, right, across the UK and Ireland, right? And then the last one will usually be at the Hay Literary Festival in a big tent in Herefordshire on the border with Wales, right? And it'll be 1,200 people in a big marquee. But because it's a marquee, there's no facilities outside to serve drinks and deal with an interval. So you kind of do a shortened, straight-through 90-minute version of the show rather than the full six-hour extravaganza that you're about to enjoy tonight. It's a different sounding laugh, that one, isn't it? If you listen to it. It's more ha-ha-ha-ha kind of a tone to it. So I'm doing this, and because it's the 150th time I've done it, oh, the polish on it. It's like boom, 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 boom. And I'm almost at the end. And in my own head, I'm going, good man, Dara, you're almost on your holidays now. And I get to almost the end, and I'm literally at the end lifting my arms up to say the last words of the show. Just lifting my arms up and about to say the words, look, when in my own head I go, oh, fuck, I forgot to do the elbow joke an hour ago. This is now not going to mean anything. And suddenly two roads diverge in the woods and I take the path of going, come, oh wait, I forgot something. Come with me to an hour ago. And I redid the routine, putting in the elbow joke and then went, but now, come with me again, back to the finale and went, look at me elbows. And 1,200 people looked at me in a kind of a, yeah, that would have been funny. You hadn't made an arse of it. And to this day, I regret not just driving it through. I think I could have. I think I had them. The momentum was so good. It was going boom, boom, boom. I could have just done it. I could have gone, oh, look at me elbows. Thank you very much. Good night. And then just walked strongly off while they're all going, what's the fucking elbow joke? What is that about? I don't get it. Is that an Irish thing? I don't know. But he's walking away. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. It's a kind of a weird thing. And obviously what people say is if you're going to write anything now, God, write something topical because the world is on fire. Surely you can write loads of topical jokes. But the problem, of course, again, it's a two-year tour. And over the course of a two-year tour, topical jokes go out of date. You know, I was writing the show here last summer, right? And last summer was the time of all the terror attacks in London. And so I had a routine about how strange it was to be in London at the time of those terror attacks, right? And then the other weird thing of during those attacks, when people would go on Fox News, right, to talk about how, well, London, parts of London are under Sharia law. And we'd all be sitting there going, what parts of London are under Sharia law exactly, right? And obviously, the hosts of Fox News don't care whether this is true or not. They're just there going, oh, tell me about the Sharia law. Tell me about the Sharia law. I didn't do that bit in Dubai. And then they go on and say, and this is my favorite racist dog question, they go, well, there are parts of London which are no-go areas. Do you remember this? That ordinary Londoners won't go into. Oh, there are no-go areas. And we'd all be sitting there as ordinary Londoners, right, going, what are you talking about? There's no part of London that Londoners won't go into. It's a ridiculous thing to say. There is no no-go area for ordinary, well, one. There's one place in London that Londoners won't go into. It's just outside Leicester Square. It's called the M&M store. It's four stories of something to do with M&M's. We never go into it. We all walk past it going, what in the house? Are they sustaining this for four stories, right? I occasionally just open the door and go, this is not a thing, and then close the door again. Simply saying it is a thing doesn't make it a thing, and then close the door. You are sixth on a list that includes Smarties, Minstrels, Maltesers, Puppets, Revels, and then maybe you. Shut it down. Close the door again. And I've said this, but it is the thing. I told a story, I told jokes for a while, but actually it became more difficult to remind people of the news story that led into them. Like, it's kind of a weird thing that happens with topical stories. That's a lament that comedians would have. When will there be a news story, which huge in the UK because they tour the UK, and huge in Ireland because they tour in Ireland, and huge across Europe because they tour across Europe, but that doesn't evolve or move on or change or develop or grow or alter in any way for 3, maybe 4 years. When will we ever live at such a time in our history? Thank you. Thank you for getting that fast, because there are nights where I'm doing that rhetorical flourish for some time, until eventually a woman in Swindon raised her hand and went, Brexit? Yeah, do you think? But my being Irish in this does actually offer kind of an unusual stance on this, because the Irish are very different to other European nationals in the sense that our status in this country has nothing to do with the European Union. Our status in this country is underpinned by laws which predate the European Union, specifically the 1949 Ireland Act it protects our status here. I'm a good example of this. My wife is English. Our children are born and raised here, so within the naming game of this, they're effectively English as well. And if I could be honest for a second, if I could genuinely be frank with you, it will break my heart. It will tear me in two to leave them and take the faster passport queue. Their little faces looking at their mother going, Mummy, why is Daddy in the other queue? And supplementary question, why is that queue going so much faster than the queue we seem to be in? And even my wife's face going, yeah, what the fuck, I'm with the kids, and what the fuck are you doing over there? And me going, honey, they have to learn the high cost of the democratic decision they've made. This is what you voted for. You're happy now, are you? This is what you wanted. You wanted your country back, but you've got your country back. You're happy now, right? Sorry, I've got to go. My cue's moving. Right, so. And people say to me, but Dara, you don't have to leave them in that queue. You can join them in that queue. To which I go, whoa there, Neddy, right? That hour I get in baggage reclaim on my own, as they're slowly working their way to the rest of the world, that might be the only me time I have on this holiday. I might read a book during that hour. I might have a look at my own iPad, which would be a fucking novelty in a family holiday. And people say to me, but Dara, you can get them an Irish passport. They're eligible for an Irish passport. To which I say, you have a lot of questions, don't you? They're very nosy about how I do things. Well, I'll tell you just to tell you. Yeah, yes, they're eligible for Irish passports. I can get them an Irish passport as well as a British passport. But now I'm getting two sets of passports. And Jesus, one set of passports is hassle enough. Anyone who has kids and passports knows they're a chore, because they go out of date at random periods of time. After 3 years, then 5 years, then 7 years. And it is, oh, the nightmare is that you check in for a family holiday, slide all the passports across the table, and the nice lady slides one of them back to you because you took your eye off the fucking ball for 5 minutes. And you've got to turn to a 7-year-old and go, well, no winter sun for you. Here's 80 quid. Keep yourself in pizza till we get back at the weekend, all right? Don't blow it all on a taxi from the airport like you did last time. Follow me around for the rest of the gig now. I'm 46, right? And, you know, I'm a big guy, but I'm in good health, right? I'm not going to drop dead, right? Nonetheless, at 45, 46, it's the kind of age where you get a little bit more careful about tweaks and aches and creaks and little pains or little symptoms that you would have just dismissed in your 20s. You wouldn't have thought anything about it. But by 46, you've heard too many stories. You know too much to take anything totally for granted. And anything weird about you, any strange little thing that pops up, you're kind of aware that, God, this might be nothing, but this might be the first stage of something which is really serious and defines the later stages of my life. I could be looking back in 15 years when I have something really serious at this as being the start of something quite important, right? During the year, my feet began to feel quite warm. Fuck you, right? You don't know that that's not a thing. Don't you fucking laugh at me, right? I had hot feet. That might be something. That could be the first stage of Huff and Fluffer's disease. You don't know to be laughing at me. In 10 years' time, you could be queuing outside W.H. Smith to buy an autobiography I had to write with my eyebrow because it's the only bit of me still moving. And when I do, I will mention you. What happened when I told people I had Huff and Fluffer's disease? Well, Hammersmith laughed in my face. I had hot feet and I booked an appointment with my GP and I sat one morning surrounded by sniffly pricks in the GP's waiting room going, well, that's not a thing, that'll be gone in a week. This is a fucking thing, this is a thing. And I went into the GP and he said, what seems to be the problem? I said, well, my feet are quite warm. And he gave me this look of, what have I done to deserve this? But he knows he has to give me 10 minutes and there's nothing really at stake, clearly. So he goes, great, I got a bit of a break in the middle of my day. So he goes, you tell me everything about your hot feet. You tell me how they feel in the morning. You tell me how they feel in the evening. You don't leave any details out. This is my listening face. I am totally focused on you. I am totally about you and your hot feet. And I give him the full spiel about me hot feet, right? And then at the end of it, he went, well, I think we're going to have to send you to... And there was a tangible pause while he tried to work out, who the fuck am I going to send this man to? What field of medicine does this even come under? And eventually he went, a neurologist. I went, no, you've gone too high with a brain doctor. I've seen the reaction I got of you. I'm not going to a brain doctor, into a room with pictures of brains everywhere and a CAT scan of a brain and an MRI. There's probably a bloody brain in a jar on the desk. And I'm supposed to go, oh, you're very good with brains. How are you at feet? But nonetheless, he says, I'm going to write you a letter of referral. So I begin to rise out of my chair, presuming this is a thing he does in his own time. But no, with me still there, he picks up the dictaphone and goes, patient presented with warm feet. I'm still here. I'm in the room. Could you put a bit of peril in your voice? Could you just act it up a bit, for God's sake? I went home to my wife, who is herself a doctor, and I said, he humiliated me in that room. And she takes duty of care very seriously and professional standards of patient interaction, and she thought this was fucking hilarious and has continued to dictate this letter intermittently for the last 6 months. We'll just be out and she'll go, patient is examining dessert menu. No, now patient seems to be examining waitress. Patient should stick to the banoffee if he knows what's good for his health in the long run. Look, I'm not saying I want to have something seriously wrong with me. I'm not a hypochondriac. I don't want to have a life-limiting or a life-threatening condition. But if you present with a weird thing on instinct, there's still a part of you hoping that you're not wasting anyone's time. There's a small part of you hoping that you'll go in and go, my feet are quite warm, and he'll go, what? And hit a giant button on the desk, and sirens will go off, and alarms, and a voice will go, what is it? And he'll go, cancel everything. Cancel everything this morning. And you'll be going, what is it? What is it? No ambulance can get here in time. We have to take my car. And then 10 minutes later, we're belting down the motorway and you're going, which hospital are we even going to? And the doctor turns and goes, we're not going to a hospital. You need to see the ocean one last time. But instead I got patient presented with warm feet. And then the speech that doctors give as you're leaving the room, where they give you all medical advice in the world just piled onto you as you're walking out the door in a vain attempt to get you to completely change your life, just as you're going out. Eat less, exercise more. Ah, fuck off. Right, you know, the unicorn stuff they give you, like whatever. And then my favourite piece of crazy GP advice that they always throw in, try to get more sleep. Really, doc? More sleep? What a crazy idea. I would never have thought of that on my own. Not get less sleep? You mean, doc, I shouldn't prop my eyelids open with matchsticks every night? You're a genius, doc. Will this make me less irritable? Who is trying to get less sleep, for Christ's sake? Nobody warned me this as I was younger, how rare and precious a resource sleep would become as you got older. I remember in my 20s, I'd be going out with my college girlfriend, we'd be out dancing, or we'd be making love in the middle of the night, and she used to say, "Don't worry, we'll sleep when we're old." It turns out we fucking won't. Jesus, as many the shag I wish I'd turned down now. Put it away, honey, put it away. Let's bank some sleep for our 40s instead. I was coming back from Latitude, one of those festivals during the summer last year, and I'm driving there the following day. I'm tired of being a late night. I can feel the tiredness pulling my eyelids shut. I can feel the exhaustion shutting off parts of my brain. I'm going, this is dangerous. I'm going to fall asleep at the wheel. I'm going to crash this car and kill myself and others. I better get off the road. And I pulled off the road in the first service I could find, and I found a quiet corner, and I turned off the engine and went, right, let's get some sleep. And my body immediately went, no, it's a bit bright. Oh, for Jesus' sake. I don't like sleeping sitting up. You like sleeping behind the wheel of a car doing 80 miles an hour a minute ago. But now you're picky about it. Jesus, there is no other physical system in the body that demands attention and then runs away. You've never rushed to the bathroom with a full bladder and your bladder has seen the bathroom and gone, no, I don't like it. I'm going to hold on. There is no other physical system body that demands attention and then runs. One. There is one physical system in the body that demands attention and then backs away. And there isn't a man in this room who hasn't at some stage been staring at his own cock going, you fucking wanted this to happen. You were the one who demanded it. And where the fuck are you now? Don't you blame alcohol. Alcohol is the only reason she's here. Sleep is rare, it is infuriating, and it is the battleground. Nobody warned me that in a long-term relationship, sleep is where the battles are fought. Sure, you go to bed with your partner at the same time, you rise at the same time, but you've had a very different night. It turns out during the debrief. How did you sleep? How did I sleep? How did I sleep? I was awake from 12 until 2. Oh, were you? Because I was awake from 2 until 5. You wear your hole. I woke up again at 4. You're fucking conked out beside me there. I was not conked out. I was lying still. Is what I was doing. Fucking lying still. I did this over you for 45 minutes just to entertain myself. I was lying still with my eyes closed, thinking about things that have to be done for this family. Don't you throw this back at me. Don't you dare throw this back at me. I thought you were dead. I thought that was something I had to do for the family. At one stage, you held a mirror under your nose to see if there's any air coming out at all. There's now a brief pause in the show for couples to punch each other in the arm. And it's no wonder we're awake in the middle of the night. We worry about things, things our parents' generation never had to worry about. My wife told me about a colleague of hers once who told her he went home and he went to the computer, the big computer you have in the kitchen that the whole family uses. And he was working with the mouse and he left the cursor in the input window for Google and down drops a list of previously input search terms. And his 11-year-old boy had gone onto the computer in a quiet moment in the house to see what lay in the darker recesses of the internet. And in his excitement, or his nervousness, or because he's a fucking idiot, the boy had misspelt the word naked, and then when he pressed send, the computer had auto-spelled corrected to what it thought he meant, and then had sought, and presumably presented, a page called Knackered Boobies. Now, I am all for raising our sons with a realistic body image. Of breaking the cycle of a pornified Barbie culture. But Jesus, he's 11 years old. He doesn't have the emotional skills to deal with knackered boobies. I'm in a long-term relationship. I know what the boobies have done to get those kids to where they are now. The boobies, the knackered boobies are heroes in my house. I love the knackered boobies. But an 11-year-old boy does not have the accumulated life skills to handle knackered boobies. How much better would all pornography be if you put the word knackered in front of any of the subheadings? Knackered Asians, just people making telephones for 16 hours a day for the Western market. Knackered college girls. I will never get this essay written. This is a nightmare. Oh, the worst. Knackered MILFs. Just a video of a married woman going, I was awake. I may have not have been making any noise, but I was lying awake all night in the bed. And her husband going, you're fucking wearing off, you're making this noise. That's the fucking noise you're making. No awake person makes that noise. I have virtual adventures. I have adventures that don't really take place in time and space, like whatever. And the best of all of these, I turned up on a fake news website. Now, I know that fake news is a thing we probably just associate with Trump going, oh, CNN, you're fake news, right? But genuinely, there's a huge industry across Eastern Europe and Asia of companies who just invent news stories, who invent ridiculous news stories and put them at the bottom of other pages in the hope that you click on them and they can sell advertising off the back of that, right? I turned up on a website called Mega News 360. Don't even try to look for it. It's a ghost of a thing. It doesn't exist as a website. But nonetheless, for a brief while there, they did excellent work. I mean, genuinely good fact-checking work. This is part of the website about me. It has biographical details. It has things I've done, quotes about me. They've done a really good image search of me. And you're going, well done, Mega News 360. You've really put the effort into researching this. Only marginally let down by the headline, which was, Irish stand-up comedian and TV host O'Brien dies in tragic car crash. Now, while we absorb that information and just process the sadness of that, let me just say, that's the UK and Ireland version of that story. There was also a Nigerian version about a comedian called Winston. There was a South African version about a comedian called Gumby. Here's the Filipino version of the exact same story. Filipino rapper and actor Andrew Espiritu dies in tragic car crash, right? Which means the story, though, is standard and weird, right? I'm going to read you the story of my own death now, right? See if you can spot the bit which makes it fake news, other than the fact that I'm the one reading it out. That is pretty much a given in this situation, right? You can have that one for free, right? Here's the first line. See if you can spot the bit. See that little clue that makes you this is a fake news story. Irish stand-up comedian and television presenter Dara O'Brien passed away early hours of this morning after the vehicle he was travelling with fell into a ravine in Dublin city centre. See, the bitter irony, I have been campaigning for ravine safety in Dublin for 30 years now, right? During the 90s and the early noughties, I was a face of watch out for the ravine. I argued strongly for more bollards or some sort of elasticated side to the road. I said, somebody will die in the ravine. I said, no, Dar, no one will die. Well, I'm the fucking idiot who died in the ravine, right? Here's the next line of the story. O'Brien, along with driver Mark Bean, I have a driver. I don't even live in Dublin, for Christ's sake. That's literally there a month a year at most. How extravagant am I that I pay a man to sit in Dublin Airport in a car with the engine running, just waiting for every flight from London? Was he on that one? No? Okay, grand. I'm here, just reading the newspaper, wondering what's happening, right? I love the idea of Mark Bean. Mark, I've decided, was former Irish Army. Drove in the Irish Army for 20 years and then left. And, oh, the lack of structure didn't suit him, you know, he got fond of the old gargle, right? I went downhill and I picked him up and said, Mark, you sort yourself out, you come work for me. I've got the perfect job for someone like you. I'm never in Dublin, you don't have to do anything, I'll give you a car and everything, but you come and work for me. And Mark looked at me and he had tears in his eyes. He said, Jesus, Darren, thanks for that. Thanks for sorting me out. I was off the road and you've really made a difference to my life, Darren. And he looked at me and said, Darren, I want to do this job as well as possible. Do you have any rules, Darren? Do you have any rules? I said, I've got one rule, Mark. Don't drive into the fucking ravine. that is like the number one rule I have for a driver in Dublin. And he looked at me and said, Jesus, Darragh, sure, I'm Dublin born and bred. I know the ravine like the back of my hand. Like all Dublin people know the ravine like the backs of our hands. O'Brien, along with driver Mark Bean, were on their way home from a showbiz in Dublin. A showbiz. Oh, I'm sorry, do you not know what a showbiz is? Of course you don't, you're not in showbiz. It's a pretty special night for showbiz people to showbiz with each other. We keep them quite exclusive, actually. We don't tend to go on about them. And it was a hell of a night, a hell of a night. Anyway, where were we? O'Brien, along with driver Mark Bean, were on the way home from a showbiz in Dublin when the accident took place on the Patrick Street in Dublin city centre at around 11:45 a.m. this morning. 11:45 a.m. Fuck me, that is a hell of a showbiz. That is 14 and a half hours of solid showbizing. Jesus, we stumbled out of the place. I said to Mark, are you in any fit state to drive? He said, fuck it, let's give it a go. What's the worst that could happen? I'll tell you what's the worst that could happen. Dara was removed by ambulance to St. James's Hospital, where he was later pronounced dead, authorities said. The next line, the standard comedian, according to the police, died at the spot. You've got to admire the efficiency of the Irish police force in this situation. This man is dead. I'm not, actually. I think it's probably worth bringing me to the hospital and just giving it a go. I think why don't we just give it one last chance? No, I have ticked the box mark dead. You are dead, and that is the end of it. Oh, it gets better than that. Bean lost control of the vehicle until it fell into a 3-metre irrigation canal, trapping them in the inside. People say to me, God, do you remember that, Dara? Do you remember that moment? I said, I remember it vividly. I said, what was it like in there? It was awkward. I'm staring at the back of Mark's head because he's done the one fucking thing I told him not to do. He doesn't want to turn around. He won't even turn around to me. Oh, the mood was tense in the car. Tense. It's particularly tense because in the back seat beside me was Filipino rapper and actor Andrew Asperity. And I have nothing left to say to him. I've had 14 and a half hours of that man's company at the showbiz. I have run out of small talk. I am reduced to going, Andrew, I believe the people of the northern Philippines are very different to the people of the southern Philippines. And I'm looking at Mark, and Mark says, will I put on the radio? I said, put on the radio, Mark. He said, put on Today FM. That's the kind of the commercial station in Dublin, because Dermot and Dave are on in the morning. Dermot and Dave. And it'll be a bit of fun, a bit of pop music. Let's keep the mood up. Let's keep the mood up in the car, for God's sake, because Andrew's getting a bit depressed in the car. Let's keep the mood up, for God's sake. No wonder he's depressed. Andrew died. I died. Here's the twist. The driver suffered minor injuries. I made that man. I took him when he was nothing. When he was nothing, Mark Bean suffered. He got out of the car and he ran back up the irrigation canal. We couldn't get out. He put the bloody chylock on. Myself and Andrew are ramming at the door with the bloody Dermot and Dave on the radio and the water's rising all around us. It's a dreadful way to die. But I didn't die, did I, Mark Bean? And people say to me, Dara, why do you do such long tours? Because I will hunt down Mark Bean from country to country, from continent to continent until I find him. And I will find you, Mark, one day. And when I find you, Mark, you do not know which form I'm going to take. Because you think I'm dead, Mark. You think I'm dead, but I'm not. When I find you, who knows which shape I'll be in when I find you. Maybe I'll come as Gary, the crime-solving cockney. And we'll sneak up and you go, want to buy a fucking bicycle? And you won't know it's me. And people say to me, Dara, you're not going to be able to track down Mark Bean. He's ex-army. He'll have gone deep cover. You won't be able to find him. Well, this is my superhero story. This is how easy it is to write a superhero story. I died and then I rose again and I will fight my nemesis at the end. And people say, Dara, you're not a superhero. You don't have a superhero name. Well, you've not been paying close enough attention. All night it's been on screen. The name of this show is Voice of Reason, which is an anagram of Son of Ravine. And yes, as some of you are beginning to notice, it's even better than an anagram because there's an O and a C I forgot to put in. And an E, and then I had to add an N. In fact, it's not an anagram at all. It's just some words. And people say to me, but Dara, you're not a superhero. You don't have one fatal flaw. My feet are quite hot. But it turned out that's because the builders had installed the underfloor heating and forgot to tell us. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to walk there and walk back. I'm Darby. Thank you very much. You are good people, and it has been a genuine delight to be here in front of you. I'm going to tell you one very, very quick story and let you get on with your lives, right? I briefly mentioned there about how I was a 46-year-old comedian, right? A 46-year-old comedian, stories about, you know, about the ordinary stuff of life, right? Whereas when you're a 29-year-old comedian, it's all exciting adventures because you're 29 and that's all you do with your life is have adventures, right? And I specifically chose that number, 29, partly because that's when you start touring, particularly because that's when you start doing the festivals, like you do Edinburgh and you do Melbourne. Oh, you do Melbourne Festival, which means going to Australia for 3 months, right? And that's where you punch the crocodile and you swam with the koala and you do all the stuff and you fall in love with whatever, and you have the absolute peak being 29 of your life, right? And I didn't go back to Australia for 16 years, right? Because Mock the Week happened and tours happened and marriage happened, all these things happened, right? So I didn't get back to Australia, right? And then they contacted me last year and said, do you want to come back to Australia? And I said, I'd love to go to Australia, because in my head I went, brilliant, I'll be 29 again. As if when I left Australia, they pressed pause on the entire country just in the hope that I would return at some stage. Let's have it exactly as he had it, right? And I was going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, it'd be amazing. I can go back to Australia and do all of the adventures again, and I'll come back with loads new adventures because I'll be 29 again. It'll be so much fun to be 29 again, right? And they're on the phone going, do you want to bring your family? No, Jesus, no. Here's the thing I learned. People who are 29 when you're 29 are 45 when you're 45. And they haven't sat still and waited for you to return like the robots in Westworld locked into position going, oh, he's back. Ding, 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 ding. They've moved on. And yes, there are new 29-year-olds, but they're not looking for a 45-year-old friend. That sounds creepier than I mean it to. So I, like an idiot, spent my time in Melbourne running after a party that had ended 16 years earlier. Literally, every night, oh, wait, I know a place. No, it's now a creche or a supermarket or an airport or something, right? None of this, it had all ended a decade and a half earlier. And I, like an idiot, rather than enjoying it on his own terms now, as a someone of my age should, I ran around trying to be 29 and nothing. It was a waste. It was a disaster. And I found myself on the last night in Melbourne just going, you're an idiot. You're a big old idiot, right, for thinking that would happen. And all I had to look forward to was a night in Perth. And everyone said to me, oh, Perth, Perth is really quiet. It's the mining town. Nothing, you'll get no stories out of Perth. And I went, okay, well, serve me right, right? And I flew over to Perth, I did the gig, which is grand, and then I walked out, and I found myself in this place called Northbridge in Perth, which is the nightclub part of Perth, bars and bar, and stuff like that. And it was like really buzzy and really full of energy. I went, oh, this is really, really good. And as I'm walking around, just taking in all the vibe, a man called Dave from Talla in Dublin stepped out from behind a car and said, oh, my God, Dara O'Brien. And I turned to him and said, nothing, because we don't all know each other. I said, hello, and we introduced, and I said, what are you doing here? Dave, it turns out, has been in Perth for 6-7 years or so. Dave is a motorbike mechanic. Specifically, Dave customizes motorbikes, right? Dave runs a chop shop, and Dave is really good at it, so Dave is in with the motorbike community. And this is the one thing you've learned about Perth is, there are the motorbike community in Perth, means the motorbike gangs, which are exactly what you presume they are. Guys on hogs, loads of tattoos, and during the 60s and 70s, they brought all the dodgy stuff into Perth and sold it and became cash rich, and then to launder, to legitimise themselves, they then bought the bars and the nightclubs and the strip clubs in Perth. So a large part of the Perth nightlife is owned by the motorbike gangs, right? So Dave, I said to Dave, what are you doing? And Dave goes, I'm in this strip club doing shots with the guys from the motorbike gang. Would you like to join us? I'm going, Dave, that is literally the sentence I've been living for the last week. And finally somebody has said it, right? And just to put in this maybe a slightly more sympathetic context, I say it's typical, like a burlesque bar, right? So it's sort of female friendly. And also, we weren't being all, oh, making it rain, all this kind of creepy shit. We're at the back of the room chatting to the owners and to the staff, and Dave is dating one of the dancers. So all that weird tension you might have, oh, $20, oh, that's all gone. It's me talking to the dancers, performer to performer. And Jesus, when you do that, the gold, the stuff they tell you is, the pull pole spins. They don't spin on the pole. They don't have some magical power. The pole is on casters. It just spins. They jump onto it. It goes round. They gave me a go. I had to go myself. I jumped onto it. It's just conservation of angular momentum. You just go round and round and round and round and round. It's like a fidget spinner for the vagina. So they're telling me all this, and it's brilliant. And in the middle of it all, this sweetheart of a woman called Daisy from Glasgow, of all places, one of the dancers, 5 foot nothing, sweetheart of a woman, walks past, sees me and goes, fucking hell, she says, I fucking love you. I saw your show in Glasgow last year. I said, that's amazing. I literally just did that show in Perth tonight. We're going, oh, that's amazing, right? And then she says, listen, I've got to go on the main stage now. It's my turn to go on the main stage. But then this light bulb appeared above her head. And she said, oh, watch this, she said, right? And I went, okay. Daisy went onto the main stage, and just to give you the layout of it, you're where the punters are. This is the stage. The pole is there. But we're back here, the owners, the staff, the dancers, Dave, myself. Daisy goes on stage. It's brilliant. Really, she's a complete pro. Really, really good at her job. Fantastic. And then midway through, though, not a word of a lie, Daisy turns, looks at me, winks, turns back, takes out one tit, bangs it against the pole. Puts that tit in, takes the other tit out, goes from the other direction. You have not lived as a performer until you've seen your material performed for you by a professional exotic dancer. It's genuinely the most beautiful thing I have ever seen in my life. And I love that story, and I will tell that story for the entire 2 years of this tour. But it's a weird story because it refers back to a previous show, and there's no guarantee you even saw that show or that you remember that show, which is why an hour ago, I dropped in a little reminder of that story while telling you the story about Hay. I said, oh, do you remember that room? The boob on the pole, the boob. That's only there so the story is fresh in your memory and you can get the point of this. This tour will end in Hay. It'll be the last gig of the UK and Ireland leg, and I will have to do a 90-minute version. And I'm making this pledge to you now that if I get to the bit where I'm about to do this story and I suddenly realise I forgot to remind them of the boob on the pole routine, fuck it, I'm driving it through. I am just going for it. Honestly, I'm just going to stand there in front of 1,200 people and go, boob on the pole, boob on the pole, thank you very much, good night. And then to possibly silence, walk off while they're going, not again, every year. So, ladies and gentlemen, could you please give up? It wasn't supposed to be all about him, but it fucking was. Give it up for Tom, ladies and gentlemen! Everyone who came along tonight, I'm Gary Breen. Thank you very much. Anna Reid, good night, Paris, good night, come on, come on! Good night, ladies and gentlemen, an absolute pleasure.
You're listening to the Dermot and Dave Show on Ireland's number one radio station, Today FM. Lovely day here in Dublin today, just past 11:45 in the morning.
Can I just interrupt? You still look really hungover.
Yeah, but I was on a big one last night, so...
Were you at a showbiz, one of your showbizes?
Well, I knew it. Ah, you love a showbiz. God knows what time it finished.
Well, you look brutal. Here, I have a request just after coming in.
Yeah, who's it from?
It's from Mark Bean. Yep, Mark Bean. And he wants to play a request for his boss.
For his boss?
Well, his former boss. He says he's just left his job and he wants to play a tune for his old boss.
Oh, that's nice. It's nice when people leave on good terms, you know,
isn't it? And he specially requests the song Trapped by Colonel Abrams.
Great tune.
So that's from Mark Bean to his old boss. It's just gone 11:45 a.m. and as we always say here on Today FM, if you're driving in Dublin today,
watch out for the ravine.